Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up, we bring you a rather special edition of the programme, recorded live here at Midori House in a sold-out event to celebrate the launch of our new book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities. Our guest speakers for the evening were Henry Squire, a partner at Squire & Partners.
We very much wanted to reuse and show the layers of history of that building and then put our layer onto it. Cities are about layers of history.
Alice Cabaret, the founder and CEO of the Street Society.
I think at the end it links back to quality of spaces and what it can be quantified or not in terms of value.
Sam Potter, a partner at Make Architects.
What we're really seeing is the stereotype of the developer and the financial occupier changing dramatically.
And Kat Hanna, the Associate Director of Urban Change at Cushman & Wakefield.
For me, it is really just about making people feel welcome, retaining that talent. People pay a lot to live and rent office space, and they do it because of the people.
So join us as we unpack some of the themes at the core of our new book. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. We're here because Monocle has produced a book about making cities, a very modest ambition. But the idea about it was that we had got slightly fed up of going to lots of urbanist conferences and city conferences and meeting mayors where it felt that the debate had been slightly hijacked only in one direction, which was talking about smart cities, the use of big data. And we kept on coming back to the fact whenever we did the quality of life survey, people said to us, the reason I love my city is because it's got a great nightlife, or because actually when they're thinking about planning, they're putting the bicycle first. So it was often very simple, tangible things that were changing how people felt about their city. So we wondered, how could we corral all the things that we'd seen across 12 years into one book? And how could we also make a book that wasn't just going to sit on academics' tables? It may not even make it to an academics' table, I think. But you never know. Maybe then put some big red crosses on it. But how could we make a book that made people feel inspired? Just before I introduce the panel, one tiny thing. I live in a neighbourhood not far from here, in Bloomsbury, near King's Cross. When I come to work in the morning, I see some very simple things that people have done. There's a street where a woman who lives there, an older woman, has taken it upon herself to plant plants around the bases of every single tree, and she's done it for ages. Now, it's a modest act of beautification, but it's also a piece of social building because she trusts that nobody's going to steal them or trample on them at night. There's a cafe I walked past this morning on Lamb's Conduit Street that has a very nice sign in the window. It says, if you're homeless, come here on a Wednesday, we give away free meals. Now, that's a modest way that an individual is tackling the housing crisis. And we may not think of that as urbanism, but that's all urbanism. That's making communities, that's making us all feel glued into a place. So whether you're putting out a bowl outside your cafe for people to stop and their dogs to have a lap of water, or you're putting out some seating on your own that causes an interruption in people's day and allows these modest moments of interruption. That's all urbanism. And we can talk about, the building of subway stations, all those things, also urbanism. But we have to encourage, I think, people to feel that they can have their say, and we have to talk about urbanism and architecture also, hopefully, in words that everybody can feel invested in. Because as soon as you start, even we will be talking about public realm, I'm sure, but once you start talking about public realm, people are like, what does that mean? Well, we mean you're the park at the end of your street. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the green bits in between the apartment block you've just moved into and the next one. That's public realm. So we should hopefully be able to kind of unpack all of that tonight. I'm going to dive straight in. Henry is in the book, and he's in the book because you've built a new headquarters for yourself in Brixton and in an old department store. And I know that when you moved there, you were also concerned this wasn't the kind of operation that had a closed front door and that people were inside doing their stuff and then just going home. You wanted to be part of the community. So tell us, first of all, reuse of architecture there. How did you end up in Brixton? And what's your ambition with that piece of urbanism?
I think for us with the department store, you could take what we did there, and it's exactly the same philosophy that we would approach a million square foot master plan, which is firstly, we found a building that we really liked. We then spent 2 years engaging with local community, trying to find out how we can become part of it, not a building that turns its back on the local community and is this sort of flash architectural company, but how do we knit into the local community? We reuse, so we didn't knock it down. There was the opportunity to do that, but we very much wanted to reuse and show the layers of history of that building and then put our layer onto it. Cities are about layers of history. We wanted to create community at ground floor, so we kept the post office. We put in someone who was in the Brixton Arcade, had a little record store. We brought them in because that's part of what Brixton is about music, and she'd been there for 30 years and was being kicked out. We put in bars because that's part of it. We put in an event space downstairs that local people can use and hire and do public meetings with the council and pop-up markets and meet with... We do workshops with local school kids, and we have a bar on the top where the local community can share. And so it became a... It's almost like the village hall. We see our office as not security gates and all of that, but people can come in and don't be afraid of the public. They're actually all right if you talk to them. And we also wanted that spirit of adventure. So we have like secret doors and secret passageways. And I think that the way we've treated the department store is the way we would like to treat any piece of master planning. It's the same thing. Engage, embrace, be open, have adventure, have fun, have public realm, and make good architecture.
I wanted to ask you, just a quick follow-up. I think you have roughly 150 or so people, maybe more, working for you. How important is for them, you know, we talk about our politicians and we want them to get out and ride the tube and see how cities function. How important is for you to be, you know, not in a tower in Mayfair, but to be in a neighbourhood where you see every day the realistic challenges of running a city and trying to fix a city?
It's been fantastic. We were in King's Cross before, which is going through its own evolution, but we were there right at the sort of beginning of that 20 years ago or so, and we tried to engage with the community there, but there wasn't one. But in Brixton there is this fantastic community. There's life, there's energy, there's all sorts of... People have brought things to us and to our staff in a way that we never got in King's Cross. And so we've enjoyed that collaboration as designers. We're designers, not just architects. So we've had people in, we've talked about ceramics, we've talked about metalwork, we've had fashion designers come in who we ended up employing. A local girl came and did a show with some of her clothing. We've now ended up employing her to make things for us in the department store. So the collaborative element that we've enjoyed at Brixton has been fantastic, not only for us as a business, but I think for our staff.
Alice, you're working in multiple cities, one of being your home city of Paris. When you get on the Eurostar and you come here, do you get off that train and think you're a little bit envious about what's going on in the city? Or the reverse, do you look at your city and think, oh, poor old London, it needs to play catch up? Because there's a great story in the book which is about this greenification of Paris. And they've done a cool thing. They've said to people, look, if you see a bit of land outside your apartment block and you think it should be a vegetable patch, just write in. We'll come and have a look. And if it's not going to upset the traffic and we think it's cool, then we will help you. We'll help you in the sense that we'll deliver the next week the soil, and a week later we'll deliver the plants and the seeds and get on with it. Do you think that that approach to urbanism at the moment in Paris is giving you a little bit of head start on us, or do you think we've all got lessons to learn from each other?
Well, I think every place is different, so I stopped comparing cities and arriving in London and thinking it's better or worse than other cities. I think Paris definitely changed recently. There's been a lot of different policies about innovation, about also getting people involved, which is not new because it's always been part of the culture and in urbanism. But definitely recently, and with new technologies, there's been attempts at bringing more people to the debate. There's also what we call a budget participatif. So you have a certain amount of money which is allocated every year for projects that you submit as citizen of a city. And that allows amazing projects to happen, completely driven by the public. And I think it's a very good thing. And that links your question, I think, back to what Henry was saying about collaboration. And we can observe new trends in urbanism, which are really much about creating platforms for social engagement, democratic participation, not only in doing, you know, like your vegetable garden across the street, but how do you get involved from the design stages of future buildings to the construction even of some of these buildings? So I don't know if some of the architects around the table have experienced that or not.
Well, yeah. I think when I was just chatting to Sam, so Sam works for Make Architects. Now, I don't know if you've been down to the City of London lately, but he's been involved in a project at London Wall, which is just beautiful. It's a redevelopment project. But if you imagine in the 1960s, when people put up pedestrian walkways, they soon became a problem because in many areas of deprived areas, people were using them as a getaway route. They became crime-ridden. And even in London, people fell out of love with them. We're talking about participation. For good or bad, you had the participation of the Barbican residents in deciding what would happen to those walkways. And actually, if you look on the back of your piece of paper, if you want, there is the work of Mr. Potter on the back. So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that project.
Picking up on the Barbican is fascinating because it's really about democracy.
And do we like democracy if we're an architect?
We love democracy if we're an architect because it can give you support and it can give you challenge. And there are 4,000 residents in the Barbican. There are 7,000 in the City of London. And those are the constituents who oversee the enormous mountainous towers that you see happening there. So we had quite a challenge in that more than half the people in the borough had a view of what we were doing. But they're a sophisticated bunch, and we were really pleased to be able to embrace their view of the world. And we were very lucky in that London is somewhere that embraces disaster. We had a big fire, so we rebuilt the city. We had a war, so we rebuilt the city. We've had a financial crash. And what we're really seeing is a communities that you hadn't anticipated coming together. So we were really fortunate with London Wall to be looking at that from 2009. And there was just this sea change in social attitude towards what the city could be and how it could be informed by community and not seen as this dead place outside of the 9 to 5. And what the Barbican did was reinforce that for us. So London Wall is effectively a park which is there for the residents, for the users, the 5,000 people that occupy the buildings on the site. But the buildings are more or less incidental and are part of that layered reaction to the many disasters that London enjoys and challenges.
But was there a suggestion that, you know, we're in a world of reuse of architecture and rethinking the things we've got? Was there ever an idea that you should just rip all those horrible walkways down and start from a different kind of mode of getting people around the city?
Definitely, but not from the Barbican. And because of that democratic view, it was really important to represent them and to provide what they need. The Barbican, for those who don't know it, has these very successful streets in the sky linked to many cultural institutions within their estate. And what we did was to reinvent and re-energise the semi-failed idea of separating people from traffic and looked at how actually our cities are layered and you can experience them at many levels. And we like to think of it as this layered historical landscape. And we're fortunate to have the remains of the Roman fort within our site. We have a Saxon priory. We have the current street level. And then 6 metres in the air, we have this wonderful landscape into which we've also put gardens. And then above that, the more private world, there's an acre of roof terraces, which Schroeder's Bank, who've recently taken occupation, have embraced, but they've embraced it socially. And what we're really seeing is this stereotype of the developer and the financial occupier changing dramatically and realising that everybody just wants to really live their lives. And I think actually following the crash, there's been this big change and we're trying to keep up. And it's a wonderful thing to keep up with socially that changes all the time. And we're seeing that on the streets. And we were really fortunate that the developers, Oxford and Brookfield Properties, were completely up for embracing that and saw that they had a responsibility to the city to provide these buildings and this landscape.
And it is joyful. You should go and see. You can go up the spiral staircases. There's that amazing thing when you just see the city from a slightly different angle. You're not just 6 feet off the ground. You're just at the height you can look into windows. You feel a different perspective on your city. I'll let Sam explain to this afterwards, but he did tell me before that the other fascinating thing about it is, that, which is unfortunately in all build now, especially in the City of London, is that hidden in there are those kinds of huge barriers and trenches that stop someone driving a truck. So it's a piece of beauty, but sitting atop a whole set of devices to stop there being trouble in our cities. But again, that's part of urbanism. We need to build in security, but how you do it with a touch of panache. We're talking there about a rethink, a complete reset of the city. You look at urbanism from all sorts of perspectives. You work with a developer. Has there been a game change?
Game change is probably a bit dramatic. I think we've definitely seen a shift, and I think it's interesting looking at, well, actually, and I'll talk about the City of London, I think, probably, because for me, I've only worked there a year. So I work for a property company, Cushman & Wakefield, and I did feel a bit like a fish out of water at first. I don't, you know, wear a suit and look typical City of London. And I often get asked, people, you know, how can we change people's perceptions of the city? People think it's just banks, they don't want to come here, they're only here 9 to 5, you know, it's not really efficient use of space either, because actually, you know, you've got a zone one, actually quite beautiful part of the city that is essentially empty quite a lot of the time. So, you know, how can we correct that? So I think in terms of incremental, I mean, one thing, I think adding to the point about, you know, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, which has driven this, is particularly for, you know, for banks, for any of those traditional employers, is talent. And by that, I mean people. You know, who they need to hire and who they want to hire is changing. It's younger people. It's people often with a lot more background in technology. It's people who could be working, you know, the obvious example is Shoreditch, but actually, you know, it could be in any other city in the world. So actually, you need to be able to appeal to them somewhat. You know, even a company like Goldman Sachs, they now 60% of their employees are tech employees. You know, it is changing. It might not feel like it when you walk through the city. It's still often, you know, there's no bowler hats. You know, there are still quite a lot of suits. But actually, that importance of people is really changing. And I think we're kind of seeing this sort of process of osmosis between Shoreditch almost looking actually a bit more like the city, and the city increasingly looking and feeling a bit more like Shoreditch. So, you know, for me, it is really just about making people feel welcome, retaining that talent. You know, people pay a lot to live and rent office space in London, and they do it because of the people.
Henry, you do millions of projects. When you look at your website, there's a roll call of glorious buildings. Now, you've already explained your attitude and your take on what you'd like a city to be, but I presume that many people who come and ring the proverbial doorbell, they're slightly cashed up developers with an ambition to make a lot of money. How do you insert into those conversations the bits that we're talking about? How you make a nicer city? It's actually, can you trip them up in their conversation and say, this is great, but, or, yeah, I like all the value engineering you're doing, but can you change the conversation? Because if we're going to have, you know, affordable housing, if we're going to have places that people are proud to live in, there's still a shift to happen, and we can't pretend that that seismic shift is completed.
No, but I think that taking, you know, what's been said before, like, people are demanding different things now. And so you're able to demonstrate, even like we can say, well, look, we've done it for ourselves in our building. We've been generous in certain places, and actually it can deliver value. The two things don't have to be devoid from each other, commercial success and a good place, a sense of community. And in some ways, I think, because people sometimes default to just a spreadsheet, if you design by spreadsheet, that's what you end up with. They just see numbers and they say, well, that's how I make the most number. I could rent that space to McDonald's and I get that. And if I rent it to a little local burger store, I get that. But I think people are beginning to work out that actually maybe, not always, but maybe that might drive value. And that actually might, different people might come, or it might in attract the young talent who want different things from the spaces that might be more shared in a building. So we're constantly having that debate with clients about, well, how do we, you need this, but how do we now get the best value for that? And it's not always just looking at the numbers. It's looking at space, the quality of space, the type of tenants you might be trying to get in, the whole thing, and the public realm and the offer, because I think people are becoming much more intelligent.
Alice, we were talking here a little bit about reuse of buildings done in a glorious way here in Brixton. We've been talking about it here in the city. In Paris, you've turned a whole motorway into a cycleway, into a pathway. Is that debate about reuse? It seems to be very top of the order, perhaps because of things like the High Line. Is that a really interesting debate in France at the moment?
It is an interesting debate in France, but also internationally, obviously, because of the way cities are built and this underused buildings in the middle of the city, whether they're industrial or they're empty office spaces or the historical buildings that are abandoned or motorways that are becoming like really opportunities for new users to take place in them. So that's something we can see all around the world. That's something we can see in Paris. As you say, the municipality turned the whole motorway on the right bank into a green pedestrian space. And I think at the end, it links back to what you were saying about the quality of spaces and how you quantify the quality of spaces and what it can be quantified or not in terms of value. And I think more and more, what we take into account is the possibility, one, to have experimentation places, and that take place in the industrial buildings we were talking about, or these disused buildings. And two, with an approach which is much more human-centric. And that's not something new, because obviously Jane Jacobs or Jan Gehl all talk about, you know, putting back the human into the way we build spaces and taking into account that. But I think the big difference now is you have the tools to actually assess the impact of light or sound on, you know, the human brain. And that's something you can do with cognitive sciences, which I think is a very good thing to use.
Sam, you started off in green space, in that word, public realm. That's your background. You've ended up working in architecture practices. You know, some people think this is like the glory days, almost of like Victorian Britain, when the, you know, park making was seen as a way of the panacea of curing everything from lack of education to health and to fitness for and getting people ready for work. The park was the cure. The public realm is being ramped up its significance in ever greater ways. Do you buy into the into that? Why is public realm so championed at the moment?
I think I do buy into it completely, and I think mobility is the main reason. We no longer are tied to a desk or tied to a room or anywhere. We can be wherever we need to be. And what's great about development, particularly in London, is that you're in a place whereby most of the space is privately owned. Whether, you know, everyone says, well, the highway, well, that's owned by the borough or by TfL, so it's privately owned. The parks you go to are generally privately owned. The places, and I've worked in a number of, I've done a number of parks for local authorities, and their main problem is finding £5,000 to have the grass mown every year. There's nothing else they can do. So you build them a pavilion, which you get the rent from that, and that pays for a wonderful plantsman to come and create this space. And I think that we are spending more time outdoors, spending more time interacting positively as our world, or certainly in Britain, moves more and more towards a service industry, more and more towards communication. And the great thing is that technology is allowing us to do that. So I often have meetings in the park at London Wall. We hardly go into the buildings anymore. The Wi-Fi works. We can do whatever we need to when we're there. And I think we're seeing that change occurring quite rapidly. Now, our bigger clients are no longer financial firms. They're tech firms. The tech firms are just taking over. And their requirements of what a city needs to do are very different. They're not 1,000 people in banks of screens with no view. They're people who will be... I've literally witnessed a guy doing a video conference on a rowing machine in a courtyard.
I hate him already.
I did, and I just went, we can't work.
He could have been on a scooter. So, yeah.
And I think that's why mobility is so crucial. So you can put a rowing machine in a video conference facility anywhere. So why not? And we see more and more the reinvention of the reception lobby to a financial institution as an extension of that park that's outside. And those boundaries genuinely are blurring. You still need the private, quiet spaces, but with this sort of mobility and technical revolution, it should be embraced, and it should really power really sociable spaces, because that's, in the end, that's what makes money, but it also is what makes it enjoyable for everybody.
Kat, you've looked at both the shifts in work, and we know that it's going to change the need for office space, the kind of office space. You've looked at the shifts in mobility. You know, we know that that's changing. Just give us a few of the highlights, or a couple of the highlights that you've seen recently in the evolving city that you notice from our social changes, how we live differently, how that's impacting on then what we see in the built environment.
So probably a couple of observations about how technology is affecting how we live and then what that means for cities, and probably, continuing on from Sam is, I think there is probably one, actually, the more time that is spent online, it almost then, I think, reinforces the importance of the physical. I go to so many meetings where people say, everything's digital day, it's all online, we do these sorts of conferences. And so, well, why have you called me into a meeting? Why are you all here this evening? It's because most things are actually quite nice to do when you get a chance to interact and socialise with other people. And if anything, I think that's becoming more and more important. So I think we're seeing that, for example, played out in something like retail, where, at Cushman's, we're increasingly saying, well, retail's not necessarily just about a commercial transaction or a till. Good retail or good leisure is a social experience. It's a social space where you're actually, meeting people, maybe you're there with your kids, there's something that's potentially edifying about it. So there's that extent of it. There's also the extent to which, well, how does it change our daily routines? I'm going to shamelessly plug my own article here, but I did a bit of digging around some data.
I've been doing it with the whole book. Go for it.
That's all right. Okay, good stuff. I'll be tweeting it as well. Make sure you're following. But was actually looking at, I'm often quite suspicious when people say, oh, these days everyone does everything online. People are always working from home. And as a researcher, it's my job to say, look, just because a couple of people in your office are doing that doesn't necessarily mean it's a substantial trend. But actually what interested me about this data was suggesting if you look at things like transport numbers, there are indications that actually people are travelling to work less. They are still working the same amount, but where they work is changing. People are still spending time socialising, shopping, but they're not necessarily getting on a train to go do it because they're either doing it from home or we're actually getting these great mixed-use locations where you don't necessarily need to travel, somewhere, I imagine, where Henry has his office, where you don't need to travel between your time for socialising and your time for work. So I think, to me, they're two quite important trends, is both the routine but also our craving for social interaction.
Now, this is super mean because we've only got like 2 minutes before we're going to wrap the show. But, Henry, we've heard about this extraordinary piece of work that you've done in Brixton, and people should go and see it. It's an exemplary example of how you can fit yourself into a community, and a beautiful piece of work which Nolan Giles, our design editor, covered here in the magazine. But let's just take a snapshot from everyone of one tiny challenge in the urban environment that you would like to see addressed, and you've kind of got like 25 seconds each. It's a test, it's speed dating. Henry, what would be the challenge you think for London when you walk around the city, the thing that you would like to see most addressed in the urban environment?
I think for me, I think we've got to do something about planning. That's in one word. It's a massive subject, but I think the planning system is not delivering what we need in a very good way. I see too many developments that I think are bad. So I think planning would be something I'd really like to address.
You earn your money. Alice?
My tiny challenge
I'm not paying them a penny, by the way. It's all a lie. But
that's not what I was told.
Alice?
And I changed my mind, but yeah, because there's so many. A tiny challenge would be a huge challenge, I think, of noise in cities. Something which is so, but sensors are so underrated in terms of planning. And I think it has such an impact in the way you engage in a city, in the way you live, in the way you work, in the way you decide where you want to work, where you want to spend your time. So if there was one challenge to address, that would be that.
Sam?
Linked to what you've both just said, I'd say it's pollution. I left the city because I didn't want to bring my kids up in the air. And I think it's absolutely crucial. And there's some really great things happening. And the planners are listening. So last night, the City of London published new policy, which says that every development has to have a greening element within it. Otherwise, they won't consent to it. And they've got a clear matrix, which we're fortunate enough to inform. And I think we're really pleased to see that that's starting to happen. So air.
Kat, you've been left 15 seconds. Go for it.
Just as well you're not paying me. Dead ground floor use, less of it, whether that's vacant shops, whether that's, office spaces that are impenetrable, whether that's, engineering facilities where you can't see what's going on. No more of that.
Well, perfect. That's the end of this edition, a very special edition of The Urbanist, here from Midori House. Thank you.
Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and it was edited by David Stevens. And a special thanks too to some of our team, Julia Hearn, Hannah Grundy, Tom Reynolds, and of course, Louis and Stephanie too. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's The Cat Empire with the song Cities. Thank you for listening, city lovers.